Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Good evening once again. I'm Stephanie Ruhle, and we're going to begin this broadcast with some very good breaking news. The Senate has just voted to pass the bipartisan debt ceiling bill. The vote was 63-36. It comes some 24 hours after the House passed the same bill. It raises the nation's debt limit for the next 2 years while also imposing new caps on spending. It now goes to the president's desk for his signature with 4 days to go before the Monday default deadline. So let's get straight to NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Ali Vitali, who has been standing by for hours and hours. All right, Ali, it happened. How did this whole thing go down tonight?
Yeah, it was less with a bang and more with a whimper, Steph. Weeks and weeks of high-stakes negotiations here in Washington, covering each and every turn of them as Speaker McCarthy and his top allies huddled with top White House officials over the course of several weeks to hammer out this deal. And now the Senate finishing it up in the dead of night, sending it now to the president's desk and avoiding default with days to go until that X date deadline on Monday. That's good news. And frankly, I have to tell you that we've seen a lot of these late nights in the Senate, having votes that are done within 9 or 10 or even 11 minutes is really fast by Senate standards. So it does give you a sense that even though they did 11 of these amendment votes, they were looking to do them as quickly as possible, just trying to get this off their plate here in the Senate and move it on. I also think it was fascinating to watch just how this vote ultimately shook out. We had 36 no votes, as you mentioned. Some of those were the most progressive Democrats voting against this in part because of the work requirements that were placed on anti-poverty programs such as SNAP benefits. Senator Fetterman, for example, releasing a statement just in the last few minutes explaining that as why he voted no on this. That's also true for people like Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Bernie Sanders. And then on the Republican side of this, you see other right-wing hardliners also taking a similar stance to what we saw from House Freedom Caucus members just earlier this week when they took their vote, saying that they don't like some of the things that are in this for reasons of spending caps, that it doesn't save enough. And interestingly, we see people like Senator Tim Scott, the only senator right now running for president, among those no votes. There's also some tea leaf reading to be done for those of us who like to see how Republican leadership votes on this. Everyone in leadership voted for this bill, except for the number three Senate Republican, John Barrasso. That could be something that's interesting to watch as we see what leadership could look like in a kind of post-McConnell era when and if McConnell decides to step aside at some point. So all of that giving us some nice tea leaf reading here. But again, it was pretty no drama because none of these amendment votes, Steph, were ever expected to pass. In fact, if any of them did, that would have been really bad news because it would have meant that this bill would have had to go from the Senate back to the House, and we almost certainly would have defaulted then. So the amendment vote's sort of just a formality to get all the senators on board. And again, although it's 11 o'clock at night, usually past my bedtime, I know it's not for you, this was really fast by Senate standards.
It's also pretty unusual for Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer to work so seamlessly together. But Mitch McConnell has been signaling for months, this thing is going to get done, this thing is going to get done.
This thing is going to get done. And for McConnell, he really farmed out the negotiations to his House counterpart, Speaker Kevin McCarthy. In large part, that's because McCarthy had the more unruly task here. Herding cats in the House right now is a lot harder than doing it on the Senate side of this building. Both sides have really thin margins, but the House side, of course, is the more difficult task. And that's why we saw McConnell give McCarthy the keys to these negotiations. Several weeks ago, it was the core four members of Congress plus Biden in the White House hammering these deals out. But as soon as we watched it get whittled down to a smaller group of just McCarthy and his top aides and allies, as well as top negotiators for the White House, that's where we really started to watch this deal come together, Steph. That's not to say that there wasn't consternation from the Senate side of this. Senators always like to think that they are the ones running the show. And quite often with negotiations, especially over the last few years, They have been. The House, though, in this case, really did take center stage. And it's why we watched some of the senators like Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, really lamenting the way that that there were caps put on defense spending. They're not fans of that. And it's why we might see the Senate move on a supplemental funding bill. That's one of the things that senators were discussing tonight. The amendments went down. That didn't go anywhere. But we could see the Senate move on that at another point in the next few months.
Well, let's take a look at the Senate floor right now. Leader Schumer is speaking. Let's take a look.
It was just repeated in the Senate. Overwhelming majority of Senate Democrats voted for the bill. A majority of Republicans voted against it. And it's not just how Democrats carry the bill to the finish line, but why. Why'd we get more votes? We got more votes because the bill beat back the worst of the Republican agenda. This exercise was this was an exercise in where the American people were at, and they're much closer to where we are than where they are. Of course, nobody got everything they wanted. There was give on both sides, but this agreement was a very good outcome because it accomplished three extremely important goals. First and foremost, we prevented a catastrophic default that would have decimated our economy, raised costs, and inflicted immense unnecessary pain on tens and tens of millions of American families. Second, the bill preserves the lion's share of the historic investments we've made to grow our economy, fix our infrastructure, make the U.S. more competitive on the world stage, which the Republican caucus in the House seemed intent on tearing down. They didn't get to do that. And third, and very importantly, we did a very good job of taking the worst parts of the Republican plan that would have hurt so many families, and we took those worst parts off the table. Let me say it again. Tonight's vote is a good outcome because Democrats did a very good job taking the worst parts of the Republican plan off the table, and that's why Dems voted overwhelmingly for this bill, while Republicans, certainly in the Senate, did not. Remember what House Republicans originally wanted when they showed us their plan, and compare it to the bill we're now sending to the president's desk. The difference is as stark as night and day. Republicans wanted to gut investments we made in the IRA, in the Inflation Reduction Act, that are driving a new generation of American manufacturing, billions and billions of investments, and thousands upon thousands of jobs. We fought and fought. That ain't happening. The hard right MAGA Republicans wanted to cut critical investments by as much as 30%, call all these vital programs by 30%. As we say in Brooklyn, NFW. That ain't happening. Republicans wanted to put default back on the table in a few months. That ain't happening. Well, Republicans wanted to roll back Medicaid expansion.
On Chuck Schumer's NFW, we will leave it there and keep monitoring. The White House did put out a statement that the president will be signing this as soon as it gets to his desk, and he will be making a primetime address tomorrow evening, and we will bring that to you. With that, let's get smarter with the help of our lead off panel, Leanne Caldwell, an anchor for Washington Post Live and co-author of its morning newsletter, The Early 202. Former Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. She served on the Senate Banking Committee. And Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee and former lieutenant governor of Maryland. Leanne, both sides gave up some. So what's the sentiment on the Hill tonight? Are they both feeling like winners?
Well, not really. No one really feels like a winner here. If most Democrats, even though they say that they were able to fight back some of these major cuts that Republicans were pushing, are saying still that this was a useless exercise, an exercise that pushed the country nearly to the brink because the Republicans tried what they say is to hold the debt limit hostage by forcing a Republican agenda and forcing spending cuts. Meanwhile, you have Republicans who are not happy either. Republicans aren't happy either because the bill does not cut enough. It is too low as far as defense spending is concerned. And so it's not really a situation where everyone wins here. I guess the country wins because the country doesn't default. But no one wins because no one really got exactly what they want. So, you know, it's a bittersweet night tonight. Each side is trying to claim victory, but it was a really painful process and one that was actually manufactured, Steph, that didn't really need to happen. But there's some in the Republican Party who say that the debt limit is a pressure point and one of the few pressure points that Congress has in trying to reform and control spending. And so they decided to use it.
Leanne, Schumer pushed hard to get this thing done tonight, even though some senators weren't on board. What was going on behind the scenes?
Yeah. Well, let's just say what was happening is they were able to get it done tonight because today is Thursday, and this is actually Senate Friday. The Senate usually leaves town on Thursday, and senators really like their weekend. And so ultimately, what was happening is while there were some concerns about the bill, especially the defense hawks wanted assurances down the road that they were able to protect defense spending and do a defense supplemental if necessary down the road, especially for Ukraine. These conversations were happening behind the scenes because what these defense hawks wanted was a public commitment. They couldn't change the bill now. They wanted a public commitment for the future. Well, they actually got that. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, they put a statement in the record that they would protect defense funding in the future. And so they were able to get what they want. But I will say, the protest was not that bad considering Senate standards. There was a widespread realization that it was not going to change the outcome of the bill. So don't hold it up too much. Everyone wanted to get out of town. Everyone knew it was eventually going to pass. And so they worked really quickly to get this done. And the Senate had to swallow what the House passed. And that is something that the Senate is absolutely not used to. It's usually the Senate that dictates these terms. So they weren't happy about it, but they got it done.
They weren't happy about it, but Mitch McConnell laid that groundwork for it. Yeah. Heidi, can I ask something somewhat unpopular? Why is it, sure, practically speaking, that when we talk about the Republicans who voted no, they were trying to tank the economy and they were obstructionists? But when we talk about Democrats who voted no, well, they were just standing up for their base.
Well, it's the kind of political ramifications are in the eye of the beholder. I want to make one point that expands on what Leanne was talking about. Look, the president negotiated this package. The president is in a reelection fight, and the Democrats were going to support the president. And you saw that in the House. You saw it in the Senate. And this thing would not have passed without Democratic support. But remember, Biden is the one who negotiated it. And on work requirements, I think it's a little tough for Democrats to say, oh, this is the worst thing that ever happened on SNAP, given that CBO actually said it would add more people, more needy people onto the rolls. So there's a lot of really interesting kind of nuances in this. I think some of it's just posturing and table pounding. They can undo this if they actually pass appropriations bills and an actual budget. So what I would say is get to regular order if you don't like the outcome here.
Michael, I know that it's frustrating for a lot of people that the student debt relief was taken off the table. But in reality, it was going to be very hard for President Biden to get it over the line. The courts had already been making it difficult for him.
The courts have been making it difficult for them and for him. There is no real clear path for its survival long term at this point, either clawbacks from the Senate or the House, and certainly what the courts could potentially be doing over the next year. So the president made a sacrifice here as he had to in order to get this done. I think to Leanne's important reporting, the fact of the matter is this was highly avoidable. It was really avoidable because all of the sanctimony from Republicans about their concern for the debt and the deficit wasn't there the three times mm-hmm. that they raised it. Trump was president. In fact, the Democrats were like, we get the importance of not bankrupting the country and we'll give you a clean debt bill, which they did three times. 17, 18, and 19. So, you know, the political posturing here is a little bit underwhelming for me. This is like, oh, this is so close. Oh, my God, I can't believe we got to cut the BS. The bottom line is two things. One, you don't need to do this. Pass a budget for the damn country. Number one. All right. It hasn't done. You know this. You know this, Stephanie. This country hasn't had a budget in 20 years. All right. Pass a budget. And two, eliminate this farce, this debt circus that we go through every 18 or so months. Just stop it. We're the only developed country outside of Denmark that does this stupid. And Denmark doesn't do it because they set the level so high, they'll never reach it. So the reality of it is, this is all political posturing to what Leanne wrote and has been reporting, what all of us watching this program know. And we need serious players in the Senate, in the House, to deal with the fiscal health of this country if you think we're going to grow an economy for the generation that's graduating this week, next week, and the weeks ahead.
Thank you. Amen. Hallelujah. And right on to all of the above. Heidi, I basically heard a similar sentiment from Chris Murphy last night after the House passed, who said this is not a big accomplishment. This isn't something we should be celebrating in a significant way. Watch this.
Let's be clear. This is not an accomplishment. Right. All we did was prevent default by raising the debt ceiling. This is something that we have done routinely as a Congress, you know, over 60 times. And we are in this circumstance only because we have a bunch of juvenile delinquents that are in charge of the House of Representatives.
He basically laid it on the line there. So the idea that they raised the debt ceiling and some of us are saying, wow, maybe this is a good sign for a future of bipartisanship. Is that just naive?
Well, sure is. I mean, I think that the one thing that is new here is the fact that now we have people who are looking at taking this to the courts under the 14th Amendment. It's what happens when Congress doesn't do its job and doesn't do its job well. People turn to the courts. They turn to alternative measures. And let me tell you, Article 1 is Article 1 for a reason. That tells Congress to do its job. And Chris is right. You know, this is a farce of a magnitude. And you know what? What's interesting, and you would know this, Steph, the markets really didn't react to this because, you know, you call Wolf how many times? Eventually they say they'll get it done. They just want attention for the next couple, 3 weeks. They want to pound the table. Eventually it will pass. And the markets knew that. We didn't see any downturn as a result of this. And so quit playing games, get the job done, and then do a budget and actually put this country on a fiscal path forward, which actually deals with our debt and deficit in a reasonable way, not in a crisis, a manufactured crisis in the United States Congress. So get over yourselves, get your job done, and hopefully the 14th Amendment case will not be mooted by this whole thing. It will be allowed to proceed. And God willing, the 14th Amendment, which says you should pay your debts, will actually be the deciding factor on whether we go through this farce again.
Of course, the markets didn't blink, because what was it, 4 weeks ago, Kevin McCarthy gave a speech on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, wink, wink, nod, nodded at all of them and said, boys, don't worry, we'll get it done. And then in the weeks that followed, we had to watch all of them put on this big show and we had to follow every single torturous breath of it. Yet, Michael, we're relieved that it's done, but there are former President Donald Trump and some other significant Republicans that are still saying the deal shouldn't have gotten inked. Doesn't this look foolish for them?
It does to a broader population of folks out there, voters or non-voters, who pay attention to this stuff where it matters. But this isn't that. Those noises aren't for you and me, the audience that's watching right now. Those noises are for the base, the craven base that don't understand that the first persons who get plugged in the you-know-what, if we default, is them, right? Is them. So all of this, you know, let's shut it down. Let's eliminate the IRS. Okay, you eliminate the IRS, baby. Who's going to, how do the bills get paid? Because where does the money come from? The money comes for us. You're just going to voluntarily all of a sudden now file your income tax return knowing that you're not going to get audited or caught? No. These systems are in place because they have to deal with human beings, right? And we're always looking to cut corners, and playing to that negative narrative is what this is about. This isn't about to the senator's point of moving the country forward, right? I mean, Heidi has it exactly right. This is about getting a budget in place and setting the path for the country. And we can have, Heidi and I can come on this program at 11 o'clock at night and debate whether or not we should raise or lower taxes or whether we should spend for X or Y. But we do that in the context of counseled, smart, deliberate leadership that is looking at these issues and trying to figure out the best way forward for every citizen in the country. So to her point, stop the hysteronics, the noise, the catcalling, the brain. You're appealing to a very narrow group of people who at the end of the day, you know, are going to be the first to get screwed when you don't do your job.
So, Steph, can I make a point?
Yes.
Donald Trump, a quarter of the debt that we're in on a dark side was all because of how he ran the country and ran the economy. And you add to that, he famously said, "I am the king of debt." And now he's the fiscal conservative. Give me a break. I mean, the record just does not reflect any kind of credibility to that statement. And, it just reminds us all that we need to be very, very careful when we vote in 2024.
And a reminder to our audience, when you talk about funding the IRS, for the last couple of years, when there was an enormous backlog in people getting their returns, when there was absolutely no one to answer the phone when you had a question, when we all complained that the computer systems at the IRS were decades outdated. You know why? It's because they didn't have any money, which was why the IRS got funded in the last year. If you're wondering next year, why is it you're not getting your return on time? Remember this night. Leanne Caldwell, Heidi Heitkamp, Michael Steele, great to see you all. When we come back, we're going to dig into Donald Trump on tape discussing a classified document he kept after leaving office. Peter Baker and Charles Coleman are here on what it all means. And later, they are considered some of the most ruthless fighters in the war in Ukraine. Richard Engel has a rare and very difficult look at Russia's Wagner Group and what they are doing in Africa. You don't want to miss this. The 11th hour just getting underway on a Thursday night.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Donald Trump is responding to reports that Jack Smith has a recording of Trump himself talking about a classified document. A source tells NBC the special counsel's office has audio of Trump, quote, discussing a classified planning document he had taken from his time at the White House. The source says the document was related to Iran, and the former president acknowledged on the tape that it was, in fact, classified. NBC News has not heard this recording, but Trump was asked about the investigation tonight during a Fox town hall in Iowa.
I don't know anything about it. All I know is this. Everything I did was right. It's a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time. It's a hoax.
Everything I did was right. Back with us tonight, Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for The New York Times and former New York prosecutor and civil rights attorney Charles Coleman. Charles, NBC reports that the recording was from July of 2021 and was played for the grand jury. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me a lot, Stephanie. What we have been having this conversation about with respect to the Mar-a-Lago documents case has all been about Donald Trump's intention. And it comes down to the timeline. So when you're talking about this timeline and where this recording possibly fits, what it does is it takes away even more the argument that, number one, these documents were declassified because allegedly it is now basically reported that you knew that they weren't declassified. And number two, that you did not sort of know that these documents were being sought. All of this can go out the window. But I want to make a point. Your lead in, the first three words you said were, Donald Trump is responding. That is a problem. That is the problem.
Why?
Because when you are in the midst of an investigation and you are
Be quiet.
You know, as a former prosecutor, I can tell you, it's very rare that you get a smoking gun. That's the stuff for TV. That is the stuff for sitcoms and drama. And I realize it's very exciting, but it's not realistic.
But he's made for TV.
Donald Trump has managed to provide prosecutors with smoking arsenals. I've never seen anything like it. And it's something that he is insistent upon doing because he will not shut his mouth.
Because it works for him in the media sphere. It works for him in the political sphere. And he has not yet faced Department of Justice consequences.
That's correct. It worked for him in the court of public opinion, but it is not going to work for him in a court of law. That is why you see so much turmoil with respect to his legal team and why you continue to see prosecutors build stronger and stronger cases and why these indictments are, to quote Fannie Willis, imminent in nature.
Peter, I dream of living in a world where I might say everything I did was right. I mean, it's extraordinary to even hear someone say that. We heard Trump in that town hall. What are you hearing from Trump world tonight?
Well, Steph, I think everything you do is, in fact, right. So I'm on your side here. Look, you know, what's fascinating about this is he is acknowledging on this tape, so the reporting tells us, that he has a classified document. He knows it's classified. What's more interesting is he says on this tape, according to the reporting, that he can't give it out. He'd like to give it out to dispute what was written actually by my wife, Susan Glasser, in The New Yorker, an article apparently that made him mad about General Milley and Iran. He wanted to show this classified document to people to prove that Milley wasn't right. It wouldn't do that. Actually, of course, he's distorting what the document was, according to sources. But in any case, what he is demonstrating here is that he knows not only that it's classified, but that it hasn't been declassified. Remember, his answer to a lot of these questions has been, well, I declassified everything when I left the White House. I declassify things when I think about it. Remember, he said he could telepathically, in effect, declassify anything he wanted. Well, here he seems to be acknowledging, again, according to the reporting, that he knows that he hasn't declassified, that it, in fact, is not permitted to show to other people. That's very telling if, in fact, that's what the tape shows.
I want to play something our friend and colleague Andrew Weissman said earlier. It was a biggie.
I find it really inconceivable that he would not be charged. I really think this is a question of when, not a question of if. It's hard to predict, but I would think we're talking about a matter of days, wow, not months.
That's a wow for me, because I have to tell you, Charles, the word imminent has been driving me up the wall for months, like unprecedented did during the 4 years Trump was in office. But to hear Andrew Weissman say days, not months, that got my attention.
I'm going to stretch it out just a teeny bit.
Weeks?
Weeks. I won't give it months, but I do think we're talking about weeks here. I think we're talking about weeks.
4th of July explosion.
It would be huge. Now, we already know that Fannie Willis has sort of set her timeline with respect to Fulton County and talked about what this additional security measures need to be in Georgia around that because of what is likely coming. So we know that that is on the calendar. But now that we have additional information that, again, takes away any of the myriad defenses, because you got to remember, Donald Trump has offered a number of different defenses around the Mar-a-Lago case. And again, I said Donald Trump, not his legal team. Unfortunately, his legal team can't offer a defense because every time they try to, he keeps changing his story, which is deeply problematic.
And then he changes his lawyer.
Exactly. So there's this carousel of changing stories and changing narratives, and then also this simultaneously running carousel of different attorneys at the same time. The issue is, as these cases continue to mount, the question becomes, how is he, the presidential candidate, now going to manage this as he usually does, sort of talking about everything that's going on, because he is now putting himself in much deeper jeopardy and problematic territory if he continues to run his mouth after an indictment has been issued.
Guess where one runs their mouth? On a podium, on the campaign trail, which is exactly where he is, Peter. These investigations are going on, and he is out there campaigning. How do these two things coincide? Because indictments could be coming down the pike.
Well, they could be, of course. And to Charles's point that he is a defense lawyer's worst nightmare, of course, because he's never going to keep his mouth closed. And we have no evidence of that in years and years and years of not just politics, but in business. Every time he faced legal issues, he has repeatedly made a point of defending himself in public. And because the jury he cares about is the general electorate, or at least not the general electorate, perhaps, but the Republican electorate, let's say, for the moment anyway. And so he's trying to, in fact, talk to that jury, the jury that he's convincing that this is just politics, this is just a hoax, this isn't real, don't pay attention to this. That may, of course, change if indictments really do come. The priority at that point is going to be a different one, presumably. But for the moment, it's politics for him, and he's trying to influence and affect the jury that he sees as being most important at the moment.
We will be watching. Peter Baker, Charles Coleman, thank you so much. When we come back, a war-torn African nation leaned on a ruthless group in its time of need, but that help came at a very steep price. We have an almost unbelievable look inside a country run by Russian mercenaries when the 11th hour continues. Russia's private army of mercenaries are considered some of the most ruthless fighters in the war in Ukraine. But that is not where they make their money. They do that in Africa, especially in the Central African Republic, where they're exploiting the war-torn nation to reward themselves while the people there are starving to death. NBC's Richard Engel has this devastating story for us, and we warn you, many of these images are more than disturbing.
The Central African Republic is a failed state, torn apart by civil war. In the capital, Bangui, I saw children starving to death at the only pediatric hospital.
What's it like for you, as the director here, to see all these cases?
It upsets me, she says. Mothers don't have money to buy food, and the children fall into this state. They are young victims of Africa's resource curse. Desperately poor people, living on land with vast, untapped wealth. Here, it's gold and diamonds, but they're not lifting people out of poverty. Much of the riches are now flowing to Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group. Russia's private army, known for its brutality in Ukraine. Wagner is led by Yevgeny Prigozhin, President Putin's former caterer turned commander. In Ukraine, Wagner fights for the Kremlin. It makes its money here. According to two Western diplomats, Wagner extracts $500 million a year from this country in gold, rare timber, and blood diamonds. This woman, who asked us to conceal her identity for her protection, lived near the village of Indasima, where her husband was a gold miner. She told me how Russian mercenaries drove the villagers away.
They were beating people, whipping people, and chasing them away.
When her husband and seven others refused to leave, they were executed.
What do you think the Russians wanted? Gold? You think it's as simple as that?
Yes, they came for our wealth and for our gold. Today, my children don't have a father. They don't have anything at all.
Working with the research group The Century, NBC News reviewed more than a dozen allegations of Wagner violence, including at Indasima. This was Indasima in 2019, before the Russian takeover. An image taken this month shows the mine has expanded dramatically, now capable of generating untraceable profits. Wagner was invited into the Central African Republic by the government to help crush a rebellion. The government quickly became dependent on Russian support. Wagner even provides the personal security for the president.
Mr. President, it's a real pleasure. Richard Engel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
What do you say about reports that allege that the Russian forces, who you brought in to help secure this country, have committed abuses?
Listen, we are a responsible government and there are laws in this country. We have set up a commission of inquiry to see if the facts reported in these reports are true.
The government relies on Wagner to survive. Wagner pays itself in gold. The people are left starving.
We reached out to Prigozhin and he responded with a voice note, calling our questions provocative and saying in part, quote, "You've received enough information. If by asking these questions you intended just to spit at me, then I suggest you come closer. And after that, try to figure out if it's your throat in my hands or someone else's.
With me now, Ben Rhodes, former Deputy National Security Advisor for President Obama. Ben, I can't even say that was a chilling threat from the leader of the Wagner Group. It was maniacal. Who is this guy and how did Putin come to rely on him? It's like you can't even believe this villain is a human.
Yeah, well, he's kind of a textbook, you know, villain in a lot of ways for this war. He was close to Putin. He was Putin's caterer, often referred to as Putin's chef. But he translated that into kind of an oligarch position. He took control of this Wagner mercenary group, which for several years has really been the front of the spear for Russia in its efforts to control natural resources in Africa. And so as Richard's report makes clear, this is gold. This is also cobalt. These are the kind of resources that are necessary for phones, for batteries, for clean energy. They're all across Africa, fomenting political instability and trying to get control of natural resources. They also were the people that did a lot of the dirty work in Syria for Vladimir Putin. So they grew in prestige and in wealth the last several years, as they basically were this private mercenary force for hire across Africa. In return, they took control of these natural resources. And in the context of the Ukraine war, they've now become frontline fighters and have delivered a victory in Bakhmut that was many, many months and many, many casualties in the making.
So what's their ultimate goal? To get paid?
So I think the people's basic, you asked about Prigozhin, I think the basic idea was this guy could get rich. He could become maybe a billionaire, and Putin could get, you know, some of the cut, obviously, and also have the use of this Wagner group. I think what's happened in Ukraine is we started to see Prigozhin take shots at the Russian command structure, maybe even distance himself a little bit from Putin. So people are starting to wonder, Steph, hey, this guy has his own troops and he has his own wealth from all these natural resources that he controls in places like Africa. He's one of the only people who could potentially challenge Putin. The point is, though, that he would not challenge him from a point of liberal democracy. This guy is power hungry as well. He's wealth hungry as well. So if he can get a good deal and he feels like he's being rewarded within the system, he may stay there. But he's also someone who is one of the only people in Russia who might challenge Putin because of his own independent power bases.
And that's my question. Why is he doing that? Because this cozy relationship with Putin has made him rich and powerful, which is exactly what he wants. So why is he suddenly criticizing the Kremlin and threatening to pull his mercenaries from Ukraine?
Well, like a lot of these Russians who are in positions of power, you don't know whether it's an interest in wealth and power, which it may be. He may see an opportunity, an opening to be someone who's there if things go badly for Putin inside of Russia. But he also seems to genuinely be a pretty virulent and aggressive Russian nationalist. And so there's a bit of ideology to Prigozhin as well. What's clear is he's a player. And he's a player who has men with guns who are working for him. And he has probably billions of dollars in wealth in several African countries where the Wagner Group is on the front lines. They're also in places like Syria, again, where they're in pretty close proximity to American forces. And we've seen actually Wagner forces killed in American airstrikes inadvertently in the past. So he's also someone who's kind of butted heads with the United States. Definitely someone who's going to be heard from throughout the course of this war in Ukraine, and maybe one of the few people who could potentially challenge Vladimir Putin. But, you know, he may just be doing that to get, you know, that may be not just a power play against Putin. That may be, hey, I'm going to make some noise. You better reward me. And so he may also be trying to get Putin to favor him some more.
Squeeze more out of Putin and get him to pay up. Ben Rhodes, thank you so much for being here and breaking down that really disturbing story. Coming up, companies are fighting to fill millions of job openings as more workers are rethinking what success looks like. Our next guest has a new roadmap for finding meaning and what you do when the 11th hour continues. America is at a turning point in work. 70% of Americans are unhappy with what they do. 3/4 of Americans plan to look for a new job this year. 100 million Americans now work remotely, at least part-time. That is 2/3 of the workplace. And all these numbers are unprecedented. So how do employers find workers and retain them? And how do employees start actually liking what they do? Well, I'm happy to welcome Bruce Feiler, author of the new book, The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a Post-Career World, which was released this week. I just want to start with it. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Because this idea that people don't like their work,
yeah,
it's not new, right? Take this job and shove it. I'm pretty sure that was coined years and years ago. So why is it now that we're saying, yeah, take this job and shove it? Is it that we've got more money saved? Why do we feel like we can do that?
This is, in fact, the big change, is the turn to meaning. I call it the meaning moment, right? So as you know, my work is about helping people navigate life transitions. I have traveled across the country collecting hundreds of stories of people who made these kinds of changes to find meaning in their lives, to try to figure out what do they know. And as you said, nothing involves more change now than work. And for most of the time we've talked about work, we've said you're supposed to be miserable. So now when people are saying they do want to find meaning, they don't know what to do. So what I've tried to do in the search is gather these inspiring stories of people who've made these changes and give you the toolkit that we've never had.
But where did that come from, right? Where did people find even that notion, right? When I got out of school, I never asked the question, you know, do I want to work for the man or what does this company stand for? I just said, man, I got to pay my rent.
Yep.
But now this new generation has a new approach.
So I think it goes back to what I call the three lies about work, right? So lie number one is that you have a career. This is a relatively recent invention, only 100 years old. And when this was invented, it was only for men and only once in your life, right? At 21, you pick an occupation and you do it for the next 50 years. And all the ways we've talked about work follow this linear path, a resume, a series of climbs, right? A ladder, a series of climbs. But in fact, when people say, I'm not happy in my career, it's not you that's wrong. It's the idea of the career, because we stigmatized spending time with family, making a change, spending time giving back, as well as making money.
You know, I walked away from my last career. I took a 90% pay cut.
Bingo.
And everyone that I worked with made fun of me,
yep,
laughed at me, talked about me like I was crazy and a loser. And what's incredible is every one of them now has a daughter in college who miraculously would like to come intern here.
Exactly. Because you in fact embody this, Stephanie, because you made this unright choice, I called, that was right for you. Okay. But here's the thing that's fascinating is we face these opportunities 20 times in our lives. Okay. So lie number two is you have a path, right? My data show we go through what I call a work quake every 2.5 years. That's 20 times. Okay. What is a work quake? It's a jolt, right? Or like some disruption where we're forced to, or we choose to rethink what we do.
But isn't that something you do from a place of privilege, right?
No.
It's a privilege to say, I'm going to try something new. I'm going to search for meaning, especially when you're living paycheck to paycheck.
9 out of 10 Americans in a study out of Harvard said they will give up a quarter of their life's earnings for work that's more meaningful. 6 in 10 millennials and Gen Z say they more care about meaning than their parents. Okay? This is the moment that we're in. And the question that we're lacking is, because we've been told you're supposed to be miserable, we haven't given people the toolkit.
So what's the most important piece of advice?
The most important piece of advice is the people who are happiest and find most meaning, they don't climb, they dig. They do what I call a meaning audit. They perform personal archaeology where they go into their life story and says, this is what I inherited from my parents. These were my role models. This is like a toothache, I call it, that's been nagging at me my whole life. And so what my book introduces here is a series of questions to ask in a work quake. I call it 21 questions to find work you love. And you ask these questions, you will begin to uncover the story you want. Don't chase someone else's dream. Chase your own dream.
And ignore the people laughing at you because they're sitting in miserable jobs that they hate and they don't have the guts to leave.
And they're going to tell you this, right?
I know it firsthand. Yeah. Really great to meet you.
My
congratulations
pleasure.
On the book.
Thank you
very highly,
much.
Highly recommend it as you are looking for some special summer reading. Maybe it'll result in a new fall career. Bruce Feiler, thank you so much. Coming up, parades, parties, and protests. This year, Pride Month is at the center of a culture clash. But it is not dimming the progress this community is celebrating when the 11th hour continues.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
In the early morning hours of June 28, 1969, New York City police raided the Stonewall Inn, a popular gay bar in the Greenwich Village. Back then, with different laws, police raids on gay bars were common. But gay, lesbian, and trans residents fought back. Streets erupted into violent protests and demonstrations that lasted days. The riots began paving the way for the LGBT rights movement, and by 1979, more than 100,000 people took part in the first National March for Lesbian and Gay Rights.
The last thing before we go tonight, Pride. Pride Month is celebrated every June to honor the 1969 Stonewall Uprising, a milestone that energized the gay rights movement. This year's Pride comes at a time when the LGBTQ community has been under attack from state legislatures, with over 500 bills being introduced across the country. Community events have also been targeted with violence and threats this year over 160 times. And as we've been reporting, companies like Target, Bud Light, and even Chick-fil-A have faced backlash for simply showing support for the community. After years of progress, the question is, why exactly is this happening now? Here's GLAAD President Sarah Kate Ellis on Morning Joe explaining why.
Whenever there's progress, there is a snapback reaction to it, right? And that's what we're seeing right now. As more people are understanding who transgender and gender nonconforming folks are, there is a snapback. And it's a small minority of people. Americans are welcoming. Americans believe in equality. Americans believe that everyone should live the life they love. And so I think this is a very small group of people with an outsized voice in a moment that is being fed by politicians. I mean, these politicians are building their careers and are fundraising off the backs of LGBTQ folks right now.
That overwhelming support Ellis spoke about can be seen in GLAAD's new report showing supermajorities supporting acceptance, freedom, and equal rights for the community. And I got a sinking feeling that the LGBTQ community will not let a small, hateful group of people ruin their pride this month, or any other month for that matter. And I want that community to know from the 11th hour, we see you, we love you, we need you, and we support you. Happy Pride, everyone. And on that note, I wish you a very good night. From all of our colleagues across the networks of NBC News, thanks for staying up late. I'll see you at the end of tomorrow.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.